playing that because the man who wrote that song, Norman Whitfield, was born on this day in 1940. There we go. 410-319-8888. Milton Kent is in the house, professor here at Morgan State University's School of Global Journalism and longtime columnist and observer of sports, and does a commentary on sports at WYPR, the other NPR station in town. Good to have you here.
Good to be here, Mark. How you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you?
Crazy. It's just crazy, man. Tomorrow's the last day of classes.
The reopening was last night and the last day of classes.
That's right. That's right.
Is there a connection?
You know, maybe there's a full moon and I don't know about it. There's a lot going on.
You saw what happened in the game last night. People holding up signs saying the birds matter and this is your thoughts on some of that, Milton?
I'm not terribly surprised. I think back to this. All this goes back to, and it's sort of like a larger coarseness. But I remember in the days right after Len Bias died in 86.
Yeah.
The talk in Boston.
Wow, is that far back?
Yeah. How about that? It'll be 30 years next year.
Wow.
So the talk in Boston was not about the grieving of the Bias family, not even about the whole situation, the university, how the university would survive. The talk in Boston was, well, do we get our pick back? So, you know, a human being dies, and all they were concerned about was, do we get our draft choice back? And this doesn't surprise me. I mean, it depresses me, but, you know, we have for some reason, sports seems to give us a portal, an ability to sort of separate the things that we would normally be concerned about, that we would, our ethics flag would fly. Because I can't imagine, I really can't imagine outside that stadium. I would hope that the people who held up those signs outside of that stadium would never do that, you know, in any other context. But there's something about sports that allows us to sort of check feelings that we might otherwise have. And just say, well, you know, what about my team? You guys have hurt my team. We haven't been our team hasn't been here for two. And I posted something on Facebook right afterwards about the city. Oh, excuse me. No, I'd done a piece about the Orioles and how the Orioles. I don't know if you've done a story about John Angelos.
I was thinking of the juxtaposition dichotomy between how John Angelos responded to the what happened in the wake of Freddie Gray's death and what happened outside the stadium, and to some of the fans who were drunk and attacking demonstrators, to what happened last night in the stadium with holding people signs or again mocking the demonstrations by holding up Birds Matter and more.
And Buck Showalter
that was amazing.
A tremendous thing. I mean,
I found myself
saying, I wish more people, and not just across the board, black to white, just across the board, I wish more people in life just felt comfortable enough to say, I don't know anything about this. You know, it's something I need to learn about, but I don't know it, so I can't speak to what that's like. I thought the Orioles in general in this situation have handled this situation about as well as you could expect a pro sports franchise to do it. From John Angelos stepping forward the way he did.
He did.
Buck talking about it the way he did. Adam Jones had some interesting things to say from all that. And, yeah, I still think, you know, shutting the stadium down to fans that day was the right move under the circumstances.
Yeah, as you were speaking, I was wondering if it would, you know, I was thinking about how when things were going down a few months back, the head of Starbucks decided to have a dialogue about race among his employees, and people put him down, and why would you do this, and you're Starbucks, you're terrible, and all that kind of stuff. As he says, he with his Starbucks coffee in front of him. But that's just my coffee in a Starbucks mug. But I say that to say that I wonder, you know, I always think about it, wouldn't it be interesting to have people like Buck Showalter and John Angelos having a dialogue with their fans around this beyond that. It's probably not going to happen, but...
Well, you know, the problem is that race is the third rail in American society.
Right.
It's the one thing that no
always.
One really...
Yes.
Always has been.
Yes.
But sports provides, to a certain degree, a bridge over it. You know, we don't even necessarily... You think back to that scene in Do the Right Thing, where Mookie's asking Sal, why don't you have any black people up on here, you know, on the wall?
Oh.
And sports allows a lot, and I hate to put it in this context, but sports allows, all right, I'll just say it, a lot of white folks to sort of say, yeah, I mean, I may not be crazy about black folks, but I like that guy. I mean, I see people walking, you know, when you're at, I'm at Orioles games and I see white folks wearing Adam Jones jerseys. And to some degree, that makes me feel good. And it allows them in a way to sort of get past the idea where I may not be comfortable with people who don't look like me, but that guy's okay because he plays for my team. And he's clean cut and he's okay. Now, let Adam Jones, you know, Adam Jones said some nice things about this. But let if Adam Jones had gone, like, you know, if he'd gone, you know, started wearing an afro or cornrows, if he started wearing, you know, cornrows and was, like, dressed after games in a dashiki, how different would his image be? Because all of a sudden, that would be in the face, sort of like, you're going to have to deal with this. I'm a black man, and you have to deal with that. That's why, for instance, Muhammad Ali continues to be a hero for so many people. That's one of the more interesting things to me, too. You know, I mean, you and I were around, you know, during that time.
I definitely was, yes.
That Muhammad Ali, well, okay. But that Muhammad Ali has become this, like, across-the-board hero. Like, everybody just routinely is like,
right.
Really? Because I was around back then, and I remember back then.
People hated him.
Hated him. You know, hated him. And when I teach my sports writing class, I have to tell my students, the Muhammad Ali you know today, and that's not to say anything about him, it's just, it's interesting how the world has sort of come full circle in a way that maybe in his older age, maybe the way the world has gone, we saw that he was right.
Right.
And now he's become that, but definitely at the time.
We forget our history. We don't know our history, even our most recent history, 40 years ago. You know, people don't know the history, and so they just make iconic figures out of King, out of Muhammad Ali, anybody they want, and just forget what they really said and what they stood for and the confrontations they had. Yeah. Before, I want to play, since you brought up Buck Showalter, for our listeners who haven't heard what he said, let's play this real fast.
Okay, sure.
This is what he said in the aftermath of the fights outside of the stadium and what happened after Freddie Gray was killed.
We don't. I talk to a lot of times, you hear people try to weigh in on things that they really don't know anything about. I tell guys all the time when they talk about, you know, I've never been black, okay? So I don't know, you know, I can't put myself there. I've never been, you know, faced the challenges that they face, okay? So I understand the emotion, but I don't, you know, I can't, it's a pet peeve of mine when somebody says, well, you know, I know what they're feeling. Why don't they do this? Why doesn't somebody do that? You have never been black. Okay, so just slow down a little bit.
I tell you, maybe that's just something about an issue of my own, but I also love hearing people like Buck Showalter, born in the South, with his Southern accent, saying that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's not a thing that, you know, and I'm trying to think, you know, Joe Girardi from the Red Sox or John Gibbons from the the Yankees, good Lord, or John Gibbons from the Red Sox. That's not something that they could necessarily speak to. But it's interesting the entree that we get that a guy like a Buck Showalter, the son of a principal in Florida, he's got more entree on this thing than a lot of other people because to some degree he's either lived it directly or he's been of the generation that followed when that happened. Because he's in his mid-50s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
So he may not have necessarily known precisely about all this stuff, but you know that there have been discussions in his household about what the South used to be. So his ability to speak to that does give him kind of an entree. And again, and it's funny, you know, in a sense, all he basically said was, I'm ignorant on this, right? And we want people to be a little more learned. But the fact that he was just willing to say, I just don't know.
And he didn't have to say anything.
He didn't have to say anything. You're right. And to challenge, I'm sure he's probably challenged his players, you know. Before you say something, before you go out in public, and because you're representing not just yourself but the club, be sure you know what you're talking about. You know, have some, and you know, sports does. Even when I talked a couple minutes ago about being the third rail, it also does give. I've always believed the ability for people who don't have anything else in common to come together on an issue that they might not even to find common ground. You know, I always talk about the old, you know, my church is on 33rd Street and there's a giant right across from there. And I can go in there after church and I'm in, you know, like right after the service is over Sunday morning and, you know, the game's coming on. And I'm standing behind somebody who lives in that neighborhood, you know, lives in maybe he's coming down from Waverly or Govins. And they have nothing. We have nothing else in common. but they see me, you know, maybe a white person. I'm standing there. I'm black, and we're just standing there. And what about today's game? When we leave that checkout line, our lives go back to being what they were before. But in that couple minutes, we find common ground. And that, to me, is the value of sports beyond just the wins and the losses. It's the ability for people who know nothing about each other and care nothing about each other to at least find something. Because we spend most of our lives being separate or being separated. But in that moment, stuff like that, you know, you really can find commonality. And, you just hope that the people who play the games live up to that and understand that responsibility, if that makes sense.
It makes sense. And it's interesting that sign, from those two signs from last night in the stadium, are the things that got emblazoned rather than anything else. I mean, that was, you know, and what it says about what happened that night, I don't know how much more you can make of that, you know.
Well, I think it speaks more to privilege. I mean, I think as much as anything, it speaks more to privilege than it does to race in a certain sense or class. Because look at where they were. They were down near the – they weren't up in the nosebleeds. They were down near the dugout. So whoever those guys were, they paid a pretty penny for those seats.
Right.
And they felt like it entitled them. You know, this is my club, and I'm angry because I couldn't watch them in person the last couple of weeks because of all this mess. And I'm tired of these people. What are they protesting for? You took away my baseball. I don't think it had anything. I mean, maybe I'm being naive. I think it has very little to do with race more than I think it's more class. I hope.
No, that's interesting. I did realize they were down front. I could tell by the shot that they were down by on top of one of the dugouts in the Oriole dugout, I guess.
Yeah. And I don't blame the club for this because you can't. I mean, you know, that's one of the joys of the First Amendment. You've got to let people be idiots, even when it's against your nature, your best nature, or their best nature. You have to allow people to be idiots. As long as you don't harm anybody, you got to allow them to be idiots. And what the club did last night was basically say, you know, all right, fine, if that's how you feel.
And my producer just sent a piece from April 27th at our stadium. Holding signs in the stadium saying, rest in power, Freddie Gray, and Black Lives Matter to O's fans. White people holding those signs up.
Really?
Yes.
Yeah, well, you know, some.
Right?
I choose to believe that there are many more people who get it than don't. And I'm just sorry that that group of people, you know, those folks who don't get it, were exposed that way last night.
And it is the third wheel. I mean, let's try to get a quick call in here before we have to roll, okay? 410-319-8888. Jada in Baltimore, you're on the air. Hi, Jada. Welcome.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yes, I want to maybe agree and maybe push back a little bit on your speaker about sports. And I'd like to just remind the listening audience about the history of African descent people, specifically the men in sports. Again, this is from slavery. We were just falling dance men. They used to shoot guns at our feet to make us dance because we had, of course, the superior skill of dancing and that innate rhythm inside of our souls. So this is nothing new. They used to grease black men down and make them fight, just like they do cocks and stuff. And this was our role, to entertain them. So to your call, I'm not trying to be insulting, and I know they pay a lot of money now for entertainment, but answer me, isn't this the traditional role of black people to entertain the white man, okay?
Do we have to take a break here real fast? Are we on the cusp? So can you stay for just a couple minutes to answer that question?
Sure.
And take
sure.
One more call, then we'll go to our next segment. 410-319-88. Don't go away, Theodore. I'm going to let our dear friend Milton Kent answer that question. We'll be right back.
Saying something about a queen. There were peasants singing and drums. The moment I wake up, before I put on my makeup, I say a little prayer for you. Walk home in my hair now, and wondering what dress to wear now. I say a little prayer for you. Forever, forever, you'll stay in my heart and I will.
I say a little prayer. The wonderful Dionne Warwick. written by Burt Bacharach, who was born on this day in 1928. The man could write some songs.
Yes, he could. Amazing songwriter.
That's Milton Kent staying with us here in the next few minutes, who is an amazing writer. Not a songwriter, but an amazing writer, sports writer, professor of here of sports writing and more at the Global School of Journalism, and a commentator on WIPR, the other NPR news station. So,
I know.
410-319-8888.
That's the fourth rail.
No, I'd like that rail go.
Okay, good.
That rail's gone. I'm not even worried about that rail no more.
Good.
But let's answer the Kadrias Keswani and then get two quick calls in a row and respond to them and we'll roll.
Yeah, real quick, Jada, I understand your perspective. And, you know, maybe at some point you could have made that argument that you know, black men in sports are, you know, I don't know if I'd use step and fetch it, but it certainly, you know, took a different demeanor. The argument, though, I think what's happened over the years, so much money has come into the system that in large measure, you can make the argument that black people are black men and black women are part of the system. You've got Michael Jordan, who owns the Charlotte Hornets, Paula Madison, who was here on campus for a while this semester, who was an owner of the WNBA's Los Angeles Sparks.
Yeah.
So it's hard to make the argument that, you know, a black athlete or a black man or a black woman who's in sports these days is a part of that sort of smile and shine for the white man, because in many cases they're part of this. They're a big part of that system too. So, I hear what you're saying, and maybe 20, 25, 30 years ago that was the case. I just don't think that's the case now.
Let me go to the phones here. I think that things have progressed. Some things are the same. Underlying tones are part of it.
Mm-hmm.
It's part of the kind of unconscious power of race in America. I think that's all part of it as well. 410-319-8888. Theodore in Baltimore. Sorry.
Yes, it's a very interesting conversation. But in reference to race, it's a sad thing. You know, human beings have hated each other for eons, and I think until the good Lord comes, it's going to continue. But in reference to the gentleman thinking that it's class, no disrespect to him, but I've found out that the greater the education that one of us has as African American, it's almost like they're afraid to talk about race and to label a person for what he is. If he's been in the Baltimore area, he remembers one of the guys in the Hall of Fame, guy who should have ended his career here, Eddie Murray. They hounded him out of town because he was so smooth at what he did. He didn't get his uniform straight. He dirty. So in reference to Muhammad Ali and things like that, you got to remember, and black people know, people don't care about you, but they determine, I can make money, so why be racist? And the thing about it, when a person is like that, they hurt themselves more than they hurt me. Race is a part of a great, and it'll always be a part of this country because of the history of this country. Now, I'm not saying everybody is a racist, but I would like gentlemen, like the gentleman who was accomplished, has degrees, et cetera, to be unafraid no matter whose program he's on and no matter what venue he's in, to call a spade a spade. If you talk about, you think that situation was about class, can you tell me, what was the source of the South Carolina congressman calling the president a liar at the State of the Union address? Was that source politics or was it race?
Sir, with all due respect, you and I don't necessarily have an argument. What I said didn't come across. I don't think every instance is about race. I don't think that this instance last night was about race. I thought it was more about class. But do I look, as a black man in America, I'm 52 years old, and I may not necessarily have walked the same journey that you have, but do I think that there have been moments where I've been held back perhaps because of the color of my skin? Definitely. I'm not that naive. I was born at night, but it wasn't last night. I know what the deal is, and I certainly understand that. What I'm saying is I'm not sure that every instance is always about race. It may necessarily be about class. I think those drunken guys last night holding up a sign at Oriole Park was more about class than it was about race. I could be wrong, and that's my perception, and you're entitled to have a completely different view, and I respect that.
And I think that there's that in this country, there's always been the intersection. It's not, to me, it's never been either or. There's an intersection of class and race in America that has defined this country from the beginning. We've not wanted to accept either the class definition of America or the racial definitions of America. And I think now we're just beginning to kind of forcing the issue of defining America by race, which we've never done before really in a really serious way, or acknowledging it, I should
right.
say, acknowledging it as a national issue, not just as an issue of segregation and racists. 410-319-8888. Let's get another call in here before we have to go to our next segment. Antonio, you're on the air.
Good morning, Mark, and good morning to your guest.
Good morning.
I have two comments really quickly. One of them is that I think it's time to do a metacognitive shift in the paradigm of how it is that people see race in this country. The truth of the matter is that white people, for the most part, are conditioned with racist ideas from the time before they have any ability to throw those things off. And then when they grow up as adults, they find themselves having been conditioned by those implicit biases, and then they oftentimes will express them. I don't think always it's a malicious, meaningful statement, but they are things that are deeply embedded in them. And when you combine that with the love of sports that some people in many of these towns have, I mean, I've seen people in this town sporting Oriole paraphernalia, and you know, they'll slap their mother-in-law if you say bad things about the Orioles. So I think that notion that anybody would say that the Orioles matter more than the death of someone, I would pose this question. Suppose the person who had been killed was a white policeman. I would wager that people would not have signs up saying the Orioles matter in that situation, which to me would clearly designate that this issue is about race. Although I agree with you, Mark, that class is often integrated and embedded in that. And you tend to find, especially in the South, that white people who have less than high school education tend to be, the data shows, tend to have a predominantly large amount of those kind of racist kind of sentiments. The last thing is that the gentleman before who just spoke about the place of black people in sports, I would contend that both things are true. I would contend that there are involvements in them at the level of entrepreneurs like Michael Jordan. But still, when you look at the history, the Roman history, ancient Roman history, you'll find that the gladiators in the Colosseum are not much different than sports people in the Colosseum these days. And that is where people are allowed to go in and entertain people, and you get paid money for that. That's really not as different as people would like to believe. I want to acknowledge you, Mark, for the great work that you do in terms of presenting points of view regarding these things that allow us to be as emotionally neutral as we can and just look at the facts in the matter. And I think that you do a great job of that on your program. That's all I have to say.
Okay. Attorney, I appreciate the comment. Thank you so much.
Here.
It means a lot.
Hear, hear.
It means a lot. And these are very complex subjects, and that's why we try to tackle them as well, because they are complex and not simplistic. I don't believe in simplistic stuff. But the final thought, Milton, before we have to take a break here and talk about the Jeffrey Sterling case.
Yeah, I hope that, you know, I'm torn, because I always appreciate the use of sports to sort of explore some of these ideas. I just hope that they're used in the proper way. I mean, you know, and as we said before, you know, a while ago, people like Buck Showalter, you know, Adam Jones, John Angelos, and even even the Ravens. I don't know whether he's capable of it, but I'd like to hear what Joe Flacco thinks about this. You know, it's a shame that Torrey Smith Torrey Smith, I think, would have had some very interesting things, and he still might. I mean, he's still a resident of the area. But I'd like to hear what some of the Ravens think about, you know, being in a city, being a black man in a city like this under these circumstances. How do they feel? Do they feel comfortable at any other time beyond just when they're playing? Do they feel like they could go out to the community and just be themselves without, you know, without that happening? Could any of them be Freddie Gray?
Hmm. And on that note, maybe we'll ask them and have you be part of that conversation.
But okay.
Thank you so much for coming in, my friend.
My pleasure.
Always good to see you.
Better this than grading papers, I'll tell you that.
Go back to grading papers.
All right, I'll go.
Thank you. We're going to take a brief break and come right back. And you're hearing us go to break here with Neil Young, because on this day in 2008, he had a newly discovered species of spider named after him, the Myrmecophila neilyoungi. So how many rock stars have spiders named after them? We'll be right back.